Live from Western Canada, welcome to The Kindling's Muse. Intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter most in contemporary life. And now here's your host, Bill Hogg.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies, and welcome to The Kindlings, a new season, a new venue, a new time. We're in the Delta Lion pub here in beautiful British Columbia, live and dangerous. And tonight, we're going to tackle the issues raised by Bradley Wright's recent book, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told. To help us deliberate, dialogue, and deconstruct Wright's book, we've assembled a stellar panel of most bodacious dudes. And I look forward to a lively conversation with our Kindlings gadflies and your questions, comments, and feedback. We are joined tonight by Kindlings regulars, Kevin Miller. Kevin Miller, known in Cloverdale as Lex Luthor, but known elsewhere as a celebrated documentarian. His works include With God on Our Side. He tells me he's finishing off a project on oil called Spoil, and he's also tackling the sex trafficking issue with a film called Sex and Money. Please welcome Kevin Miller. Peter Chataway is no stranger to the Kindlings, and he's thrilled to be back in his old stomping ground here in Delta. As we've already discovered, he's a Charlton Heston fanboy. Not so much a fan of Ron Howard for reasons we won't go into tonight, but he's actually a human encyclopedia of all things cinematic. Please welcome Canada's celebrated film critic, Peter Chataway. And then joining us tonight as a Kindling's newbie is Mike Sherbineau. We had planned to have that feisty favourite feminist of the Kindlings, Dr. Alison Jewell, but she succumbed to some deadly virus that's sweeping across the campus of Trinity Western University. And like a real good stager, Mike Sherbineau pinch hits at the 11th hour. He tells me he's a wannabe hockey player. He is a veteran pastor, having been involved in church-based ministry for 30 years as a church planter and a lead guy in established congregations. He did his doctorate on preaching to those who have given up on faith. He reckons his greatest accomplishment, however, is that he has five daughters. And he's also done television and radio and was recently featured on CKNW's God Almighty. Please welcome Mike Sherbineau. Well, tonight we're tackling the contents of Bradley Wright's book, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told. He's a sociology professor at the University of Connecticut who kind of takes the role of a religious mythbuster. Some of us enjoy Jamie and Adam blowing up stuff on Mythbusters. And Bradley Wright, in the classic tradition of Mythbusters, wants to blow up preconceived ideas, bad research, and stereotypes that influence our understanding of Christianity. In his book, he plays the role of a mythbuster, exploring the validity of criticisms about Christianity. Wright takes on nine myths. I don't think we'll cover all those nine myths this evening, but he looks at assumptions or paradigms regarding Christianity in America. And it's the job of our panel to join the dots between life south of the 49th parallel and the assumptions and analysis that Wright goes after and how it applies to life in Canada. Some of the myths that Bradley Wright goes after include American Christianity is in rapid decline, young people are leaving the church, Christians misbehave just as much as, if not more than everyone else, Christians don't love others, and non-Christians really, really dislike Christians. Scott McKnight has offered his comments on the book, and he says that he thinks it's one of the most encouraging and myth-busting books of the last two decades. But before we go after the big one, the big hot potato, that Christians are hate-filled hypocrites, Bradley Wright encourages us to adopt a healthy skepticism about stats, statistics, about research. It was Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli who said, there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. And Bradley Wright seems to adopt that sentiment. Kevin.
Yeah, well, I think healthy skepticism is healthy. I've had the opportunity over the last few years to work on films on evolution, on energy, on all sorts of different issues. And the thing that I begin to discover as I start working on all these projects is that initially my understanding of the issue was just a headline level understanding. And I think that just is true for most people, is that we just read the headlines and assume we know the truth. And so I think the same thing happens when we encounter statistics, is we hear some kind of a shocking statistic and don't really give any thought as to sort of the human factors that go into creating the statistic. Because statistics, they have this air of objectivity to them, I think, that, oh, it's a statistic. It's like somebody arrived at that through some sort of rational scientific process. But I think what Bradley Wright gets at in the book is that, no, there's actually a huge human element that's involved in generating the statistic and then in interpreting it as well. So we have to be really cautious with it.
Peter, go ahead. How would you respond to the need for a healthy criticism or a healthy skepticism towards statistical analysis?
Well, I think we should definitely be critical thinkers, and we should not accept everything people say at face value, especially when, I mean, there's an early section in the book where he talks about how there was a study, I think it's the study which claimed that evangelicals were least respected of all different groups that were surveyed, except for prostitutes, supposedly.
Right.
I think that's the study. And he talks about how it began with a study which was itself kind of questionable. There were questions you could ask about the study. The study got picked up by a news report, and so like a legitimate news source. And then that news source got picked up by a website, which got picked up by a blog, which got picked up by something else. And the next thing you knew, there was just this sort of accepted fact, quote-unquote, out there that evangelical Christians were one of the least respected groups in the world, and because the people kept passing it on, and in some cases without even attributing the original source.
So it's kind of like people, Chinese whispers,
yeah,
which we used to play in elementary school in
Scotland. So if you see something like this on a blog, don't just accept it. You know, you should at the very least, I mean, if you can ignore it, you don't have to check into it, but if you're not going to ignore it, if you're going to follow it up or use it in any sort of way, you should definitely try to trace it to the source. Try to find out who said that. If a blog says, the statistic is this, you know, this is the stat, well, don't just accept that. You know, try to find out who came up with the statistic. Try to find out what the study was. Try to trace it back to its source. And thanks to Google and other search engines now, it's really easy to say, well, okay, this percentage, Christians, prostitutes, bingo, what comes up? And some website out there somewhere should have the information you need to get the original study. And in that particular case, it turned out that while evangelicals were right at the bottom of the survey, born-again Christians were right near the top. Well, the people were being asked to rank born-again Christians and evangelicals separately.
And Baptists separately as well.
Yeah,
who
exactly.
Happened to be evangelical.
Yeah, so...
And maybe even born-again as well.
Yeah, so that raises all sorts of questions about how the study was conducted and what sense, if any, we can make of the results. But, of course, that kind of nuance got lost in the fact that the story was picked up and then recycled and recycled and recycled and really dumbed down to the point where it became
right.
Christians are just hated.
Okay, and even in the book, he's got a badge you can cut out with the words caveat lector on it, and he says it's official. Go forth and think for yourself. Mike, as a pastor, one of the darlings that he goes after is George Barna, who's often respected, quoted, and misquoted. And he questions the validity of not only some of the research, but the conclusions that Barna makes. So, first of all, why are pastors and church leaders and missions leaders so enamored with George Barna and the Barna Research Group?
Well, a couple things. I think maybe just to come out of the... You know, if we're going to jump into the ring, let me throw out a couple thoughts. I think Barna, pastors love him because he gives some explanations to the situation of the church today. You know, why don't people come and why do people seem so anemic? That's an ongoing conversation wherever I go in the States or Canada. In Wright's defense, he makes something, I think one of his third theses is this, is that the Christian statistics are often descriptive and not prescriptive. And I'd certainly go along with that. I mean, when Barna writes, sometimes it's doom and gloom, and we want to get on the misery slide, we could use some good prescriptions. I think the negative aspect of the statistics almost make us think, oh, wow. So I can condone the pathetic state that my church is in, or the church in general is in. I'm in Richmond, and if you want to have a group of pastors that are depressed and discouraged, you know, just call the local ministerial. But I'm for a moment, I think I want to go against what Wright's his main thesis are, because I think Barna, while sometimes statistics can be skewed or screwed slightly, he's painting a fairly accurate picture. At least what he paints is what I see.
Okay, let's go after something that Bradley Wright raises in the book, and that is the treatment of Christians, Christian leaders particularly, by the media. He raises a question, why do we hear so much bad news about Christianity? And he seems to suggest that it's the media who want to sell newspapers, want to get viewers, want to get listeners, so they'll focus on the sensational. So we never hear a news report about planes safely taking off and landing at YVR. But we would focus on if there was a mishap or a near miss. So the question is then, as he goes after this early on in the book, is the problem media generated? Is the problem a reality issue? It's actually rooted in the reality of Christian expression in North America? Or is it an issue of collective self-esteem? Wright says in page 182 of the book, the public perception of our character and lifestyle is one of the major reasons why our evangelistic efforts in the United States have been so ineffective in the past quarter century. So it's an issue of perception and an issue maybe of collective self-esteem, according to Wright, where we sit and say, wow, we really suck. So what's the issue? Why is there so much focus on bad news when it comes to things Christian?
Well, I think it's because we've set ourselves up in some sense, and I think it's fair that, you know, who we represent, that we're to be the ones who are bringing the good news. And so, unfortunately, you know, we see it in the news. There's recent things even now with Bishop Eddie Long and different things like that where the media is all over that. But nonetheless, when things get difficult, they still come to the church. They're still looking to the church for solutions. They're like the problem of homelessness and issues like that. You know, they're quick to point the gun. And I think more than anything else, especially with all the sexual scandals that the church in general, including the Catholic Church, has faced, that becomes the challenge. And because we hate those things. And people listening, they feed off of that. And so the media knows that. I mean, they're all about creating an audience. They want to create tension. And we're a sitting duck.
Kevin.
Well, I think there's two sides to it. I think that definitely the analogy of the planes is good. I mean, when I'm in a plane that's got a lot of turbulence and I'm somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean, I you know, it comes back to me what a miracle it is that I'm actually doing this. You know, I'm 30,000 feet in the air worrying that my drink service isn't arriving on time. And that should be newsworthy. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's not just the media, though. The media knows the audience, and the audience loves to hear bad news. But I think that there's also almost a dual persecution complex going on, where it seems like certain elements of the church wants to feel as if they're being persecuted by the broader culture. But at the same time, I get the sense from the broader culture that they feel the church is fair game because it's this oppressive majority that's sort of imposing its will on the masses. And so, you know, there's any chance you get to sort of point a finger and say, aha, you guys aren't better than us. I knew you weren't. I knew you were no different than us. They'll take it, you know. And so I see that sort of a game going on, at least from my perspective.
Interesting you used the phrase oppressive majority to describe the church, because one of the things that Wright goes after is this idea that Christianity is in rapid decline, that we're dealing with Jurassic church, possibly endangered species. And as he reacts to some of Barna's pessimistic thoughts about the shelf life of evangelicalism in particular, Bradley Wright says, quick, put on your chicken costume because the sky is falling. And he paints a rosier picture where evangelicals are holding steady and the unaffiliated have jumped. The mainline is in decline and African-American churches have held steady since the 1970s. So what's the real deal, Mike, from your perspective as you interact and network with leaders across North America? Is he onto something here? Because we've heard some paralyzingly pessimistic pronouncements about the future of the church.
Well, we hear those things. I think it's already been noted, you know, we're drawn to the bad news. And I think if there's anything that comes out of Wright's book for me, it's the whole thing that how we spin things. We need to do it as people who really believe that the solutions are what we're preaching about. But you know, Bill, I'm seeing a different side to things. I saw it this past week. We all know about the pastor in Florida who wanted to burn the Quran. We're really neat in our little church in Richmond. We meet out of the theater. A guy named Jeff Tunnicliffe goes there, and he is the president of the World Evangelical Association. The White House was calling him many times in the last 2 weeks, and he was the guy behind the scenes. He was then on national news mediating. And I think he used it well to put a spin on it, saying, you know, we're not about, as much as we're against burning Qurans, are we going to get the same time if we're, when Christians, when their Bibles are being burned? And so I think we need to take those opportunities, and I'm learning from this fellow, you know, to lobby in the positive sense. And we've got to fight the bad news. But sometimes we're, as I talk to pastors, they're just feeling a sense of being overwhelmed. And I think they need to come back to a refresher in 101 theology.
So how do we respond to this issue of the rise of the unaffiliated? You know, we know that we're in a cultural landscape where people are hostile or cool towards organized religion. And some people have bemoaned this, but Wright cites a Newsweek article which quotes Mark Driscoll from Mars Hill Church in Seattle saying, you know, maybe it's not a problem, maybe it's simply clarifying that we know who is fully engaged in the pursuit of Christ and we know who's marginal or nominal. How do we react to that?
Well, you're looking at me, and I'm not sure why you're looking at me, but that's
okay. Okay, we'll move on.
This is okay. No, because that was actually an interesting passage for me, because there were several years, roughly between, well, I won't say when it was exactly, but there was
back
a period
when
about,
you were hanging around here.
No. Several years in my adult life. I turned 40 on Friday, so I'm a little shocked that I've lived more than half my life out of high school now. But anyway, there were several years where I was not actually affiliated with any particular church, but I still very definitely would have called myself a Christian, but I didn't know what kind of Christian, and it was a somewhat vexing issue for me. And the way that these labels are used in his book. Sometimes he'll say Christians on the one hand, but unaffiliated on the other hand. And I think, well, which of those two categories would I have fallen into? I don't know.
An unaffiliated Christian, probably.
Well, so both. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, like the notion that somehow because I wasn't attending a church, it was somehow clarifying that I wouldn't have been a real Christian at that time. I would have resisted that interpretation of my position at that time in a big way.
Well, we'll need to come after that in a moment, but it's time for us to take our first break of the evening for our guests to hydrate themselves, relieve themselves, take a comfort break, and for Mike Sherboneau to get some surgery to his left ear. And so we'll be back after we take a break. Thanks so much. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. We're in conversation at the Kindlings here in beautiful British Columbia. We're cozying up at the Delta Line pub. We're dialoguing about Bradley Wright's book, Christians are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told, which came out in July 2010. Just before we took a break, Peter Chataway was beginning to take us on a meandering journey through his young adult departure from the church. And that's not atypical, you know, in terms of life cycle.
Well,
young adults transition out of church, they try and find their feet at college, university, career. Maybe they get married, maybe they have kids, and then God questions and issues of child raising and how you get on with your partner. All that comes to the fore. But they continue to believe. That's an interesting phenomenon, Mike, that people who are unaffiliated do so for a variety of reasons. But there's a lot of people who are still Orthodox who would still profess to be devoted followers of Jesus Christ.
I'm
going to Mike.
I just want to hear
from Mike on this.
Okay. Well, I think what I observe is that many people would concur with what you're saying. They say, I'm a follower of Jesus, but I don't go to church. We just rented a facility out of a sports fitness bar and club, and went in and did the deal for our church office, and the lady said, I'm a Christian. She said, Jesus is my Savior, but I haven't gone to church for 25 years. And she talked to me about why she didn't go. I heard another friend made the comment, because I used to minister in Toronto, that approximately, they figure, 75,000 card-carrying evangelicals do not go to church. Now, is that true? Well, if you look at the empty churches, it would seem like that. And where I live in Delta, and I minister in Richmond, I often do a head count, and there's a lot of empty space in churches. But many people still claim to be religious. And as we know, Canadians, you know, most of them would say 80 to 90%, supposed, according to Barna, have some kind of, you know, a strong spiritual affinity.
Right. Now, you did your doctoral research on how to communicate
to the unchurched,
as a gospel messenger to those who have given up on faith or given up on church.
Yeah.
What did you have any surprises? Whoa. Bit of enthusiasm for you there, Mike.
Well, you know, that's pretty exciting. Actually, I think the biggest thing is for the church to get into the pub, to get into the, you know, into the workplace. People need to take their faith to know how to talk and communicate. And I think one of the biggest challenges, Bill, is that we talk two languages. We, as Christians, we have a spiritual language, and a lot of times we check it in on Sunday night when we go back to work the next day. And so I'm all about saying, how do I interface my faith? And I play a bunch of, you know, hockey, the typical bar leagues. And so I'm out with the guys. I was out there last night. And when the F-bomb is every second word, I'm saying, okay, how do I integrate faith? And I find it's very simple.
Was it you that was using the F-bomb every other word? No,
it wasn't me. But they always watching.
He restricted it every third word.
You know what the thing is? It's just hanging out. And I just try to build relationships and say, you know, I got to hang out with those people. Go for lunch, go for coffee, go for something. Talk to them.
Right. Now, the big idea in the book is that there's a disconnect between Christian profession, Christian talk, and Christian walk. And one of the things Bradley Wright does, but he admits it's kind of overly simplistic, he gives Christianity a report card, and he's pretty generous along the way, but he flags up some areas of concern, and I'd be interested in hearing from you guys on the fact that he doesn't give Christianity a good grade when it comes to gender in the church. Gender equality is an issue. Giving is less than what would be expected, and he says attitudes towards blacks and gays are problematic. So he's given out B's and A's, and then C minus and D's pop up when it comes to the issue of how Christians use their money, how they treat homosexuals, how they treat ethnic minorities, because most of American evangelicalism is Caucasian. So any thoughts on that? Peter, Kevin?
I find it interesting. He says here that that treatment of black people and gays gets worse with increase in church attendance. But he found that loving acts being more charitable to others increases with attendance. So that doesn't really make any sense to me. You become more charitable the more you go to church, but you treat black people and gay people worse. So I don't even understand. To me, that's that information isn't even valuable because it's completely contradictory. That to me, yeah, I think this report card to me, it to me exposes the weakness of using statistics to study human behavior. You have to understand that sociology only turned to statistics to try and justify itself in the eyes of, you know, real science like physics and chemistry and that sort of thing. So, you know, they're trying to basically sort of show that we can do math too, and reduce human being or human behavior to something that you can quantify and objectify. And as all of you know, you can't be quantified and objectified because, you know, that's not a way of capturing humanity. And so to me, I just kind of toss out the whole report card because I just feel that it doesn't really, I just find it useless and kind of offensive.
Maybe Kevin's having a flashback to high school in Abbotsford where report cards were bad news in the Miller household.
No, that was Saskatchewan.
Oh, Saskatchewan. Yeah. I beg your pardon. Do they have schools in Saskatchewan? Okay, I'm just...
Isn't Bradley Wright also synthesizing a lot of different studies and things here? So we would have to look at his methodology for how he synthesizes these reports and how he ends up with apparently contradictory. I mean, for example, I haven't read this part of the book that closely, but when he says on the one hand that increased church attendance equals better behavior in general, more generosity or whatever, on the other hand, increased church attendance also correlates with a negative treatment of blacks, for example. Well, is he including the black Protestant churches, which he refers to often as a separate entity in the book, is he including the black Protestant churches in one or both or neither of those statistics? I assume the black churches are not negative towards black people. So if those two bits of data are going to have any sort of... if the relationship between those two bits of data is going to have any meaning, then they should be based on... like what, the same sample, we should be looking at the same group of people when we look at those two things. But if we're looking at two different groups of people, one bigger, one smaller, or maybe just different people altogether, then the fact that one group is better behaved when it's in church, but the other group is worse behaved when it goes to church, that doesn't tell me anything.
That's what I'm saying, is that it's very difficult to draw any conclusions.
But I think he's one thing that we can deduce from that is the whole herd mentality, that the bigger the group, the more intimidated we are to think for ourselves. We go along with the crowd. And if you have a small group of people and you have sitting around your table and a couple of them might be a different ethnicity or have maybe homophobic or vice versa, you're probably less to come out in the attack. But when you're in a larger group, it's easy to go along with your old prejudices. And I think that's something.
Throw a rock at a large, impersonal object rather than someone up close and personal. Now, Peter, you sounded a bit more sympathetic about the report card approach because, to be fair to Wright, he is synthesizing. He's kind of wrapping up the book, kind of going, where do we go from here?
I don't know that makes me more sympathetic. I'm just noting that, well, he himself says in the book that he's oversimplifying by doing this. And so, you know, you can make of that what you will. But each item in that report card sits on the shoulders of some much more learned study. And so there's only so much detail that his book can give you. And presumably every one of the studies that he looks at is arguable or debatable in its own way. The studies that I have seen, he seems to break everything down into certain categories, like Catholic, mainline Protestant, evangelical, and black Protestant churches, and then there are other religious groups as well. But, you know, I wonder if all the studies that he's looking at define those categories consistently. And if they didn't use the same consistent definitions for those categories, then the fact that he's using the same set of terms every time he looks at a different field of sociological research doesn't actually mean that he's giving us a consistent consistent glimpse into the church that's being studied.
How did you respond to his generally optimistic appraisal of evangelicalism and in North America? You know, because we've heard anecdotes. You know, when if you mention that you're an evangelical, the stereotype is you're defining what you're against rather than what you're for. And obviously, this isn't scientific research, it's anecdotal, but the author, Philip Yancey, for a while did an informal poll when he was in an airplane, which would be a lot. And he would say to someone sitting next to him as a conversation starter after the drinks and pretzels came, he would say, if I say the word evangelical, what pops into your head? And it was pervasively negative. So how did you respond to what's largely a thumbs up to the health of evangelicalism?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I mean, he talks about how evangelicals often thrive on a certain feeling of being persecuted, whether or not they are. But Kevin also mentioned the oppressive majority aspect. And, you know, I think you saw an interesting example of that paradox when The Passion came out 6 years ago, because a lot of what drove the box office success of that film was churches feeling that they were being persecuted. Because Mel Gibson and his movie were being persecuted supposedly by the liberal media, quote-unquote, they had to defend the movie, and they would defend it by buying tickets. And so the fact that there was perceived persecution drove them to the box office. But at the same time, by virtue of the fact that they made the film such a huge hit, they also demonstrated that they were a very sizable group that left a lot of other people looking at that movie and going, wow, how can we motivate those moviegoers? Like, why are we being left in the cold? So there's this weird paradox that evangelicalism is a very large demographic, and yet it sort of often feels like it's in the minority, and in some ways thrives on that feeling of being in the minority.
Feeling marginalized. When Bradley Wright takes an evaluation of Christianity, one of his sweeping conclusions is that, yes, it is transformational. Rather than that people having a radical disconnect between what they believe and what they do, that sometimes through time that people change, that there is behavioral modification, or in spiritual terms, there's transformation. But he does flag up problem areas, albeit with a simplistic report card. And the problem areas are gender equality in the church, the issue of racism. We would say the issue of materialism, because the issue of giving, he says that you would expect them to be more giving than they are. So what does that say? That says that there's an area where Christians blend in with the landscape populated by Western materialists, and then attitudes towards homosexuality. So these are the four touch points, if you like, or the four aberrations that he would go after. Anybody want to respond to the fact that he's singled out those four issues?
If I talk about the gender issue, I can do it in the context of having five daughters. I can think of one daughter who would probably be choked reading his work because he's almost making it paint as if it's better than it is. I think the gender issue is just a huge problem in the church, and probably because of the theological background that we bring and our way of trying to process and answer the question, what is truth? And I think the other thing on the whole issue of sexuality is the church is looking for a theology that would say that what we're holding to is good and true. We all want to be painted as tolerant, especially in Canada. You know, we're the country of tolerance. And yet, the argument, of course, that many people, when they come to Scripture, is that Jesus' teaching and the Apostle Paul is pretty black and white.
Kevin, what about the hot-button issue of homosexuality? Because on the one hand, you've got Dan Merchant, who is a documentarian and an author who gave us, Lord, save us from your followers. Why is the gospel of love dividing America? And he goes to a gay pride festival in Portland, Oregon, sets up a confession booth where he confesses to the gays and lesbians who are there to celebrate their homosexuality and lesbianism. He wants to confess that he has not loved them as Jesus loves them. And in the movie, there's some very poignant, touching moments where people who've obviously been ostracized because of their sexuality and been on the sharp end of religious judgmentalism are in tears, and they thank him, and they give expression to this being a touching expression of love. And then you've got that issue, but then Leanne Payne, who says there is the scriptural view that homosexuality is something to be repented of and healed. So is there a tension there that somehow in this tolerant landscape of Canada that Orthodox and evangelical Christ followers are going to be falling foul of cultural expectations regarding this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between loving an individual and endorsing a behavior. We spoke about this, I believe, at the last Kindlings podcast. You know, there's the common belief that you should hate the sin and love the sinner, and I kind of went against that, particularly in this case, because when somebody is a homosexual, that isn't just something they do, that's who they are. And so that's when I think you run into a real difficulty, because if you hate the sin, well, then you hate the thing that gives me my identity. And so then how can we have a relationship? That creates a really difficult situation. And so I would just say at this point that it is a real conundrum. And I mean, from my own point of view, because it's something that I need to spend more time sort of delving into Scripture, because I've sort of arrived at the live and let live situation right now, because what else can we do, you know? Right. I don't want somebody to hate me because I'm a Christian, because that's what gives me my identity, you know, any more than I would want to hate somebody who's a homosexual because that's what gives them identity. So, yeah, I would just say it's a conundrum that it's that I'm working through and a lot of people are working through.
And probably the tension that you have to deal with is then, is there a plumb line? Is there truth? And does it change? Does it swing? And as we want to be tolerant of all.
Okay. Well, there's truth and then there's interpretation of truth. And definitely interpretation changes over time.
For what it's worth, if I can just jump in here. I mentioned earlier that I spent several years not going to a church.
I would like to clarify.
I would not. I would not at that time have said I left the church. I would have said that I left a church, and I didn't. You know, it's like when you're not dating anybody, you might say that you're between girlfriends or whatever. And at the time, I said, if people asked me where I went, I said I was between churches. And I was between churches for years, as it turned out. But I knew that I wanted to be at a church. I wanted to find one eventually. And one of the things that sent me into that wilderness in the first place was actually this issue and dealing with this issue. And not on a personal level, just on a how we understand, how we interpret, how we process, you know, the teachings of Scripture and connect them to the culture and all the filters we bring to that. So, and the thing is, at the time, depending on what survey or what study might have contacted me, I might have called myself unaffiliated, or I might have called myself Christian, depending on how they defined those terms. But it was precisely issues like this that put me into that sort of that fuzzy zone where I wasn't sure which way I would go. And I don't really know what direction to give on that point, except to say that I do feel a lot of empathy for people who find themselves in that situation, and people who do find themselves tilting unaffiliated because they don't think the church that they are going to is, or the churches that they are familiar with, are doing a good enough job of dealing with that issue.
All right. Well, it's almost time to wrap up this second segment. Our live audience, I invite you to deliberate over what questions you want to fire at our illustrious panel as we look forward to your questions, your comments, your pushback on the panel's take on Bradley Wright's release, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told. So there we go. Thanks so much. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. For those of you listening to our podcast who found us in cyberspace at www.thekindlings.ca, this is the point in the proceedings at our live event when I put my inline skates on and roam around the room and give our lively Kindlings guests the opportunity to put voice to their questions, comments, or go after the panel, albeit in a hospitable, imaginative way. And so I'm going to head over to table one, which is a table of brainiacs and geniuses. And the first one to give voice to a comment or question for our illustrious panel is Art.
Just a comment that I'd like to hear from the panel. And basically, I guess my comment is, aren't we as a church sometimes hypocritical? We may not be hate-filled, but we're certainly hypocritical in a sense. I don't think that this has to do with the media and the church. I don't think that the media reporting on things like sex abuse is necessarily bad. I think society and the media hold the church accountable in the court of public opinion. And we should stop crying like babies and crying persecution just because the media reports bad things about the church. As a friend of mine just said here at the table, that we claim a higher standard, and I think we should live to a higher standard, and we shouldn't cry just because when things are reported about us that miss that mark, that we're being picked on or that we're being persecuted necessarily. Any comments on that?
Great, thanks very much. Peter Chataway has his hand, he's waving it, so I guess that means pick me. Okay, Peter, how would you respond to Art?
Well, first I'd want to sort of zero in on this word hypocrite a bit. In the book, Bradley Wright does talk about the distinction that perhaps should be made that, you know, if we're going to define hypocrite as somebody who simply doesn't live up to a certain ideal or their own ideal, then probably everybody in the world is a hypocrite on some level because we all fail by our own standards on some level or other. He prefers to use the word hypocrite more narrowly to mean somebody who actively promotes or preaches a certain message or a certain ideal and actively does not, like, goes in the other direction, you know? And I think it might be helpful. I believe, it's been years since I went to university, but I believe the word hypocrite comes from a Greek word that basically means actor. When you went to a play in Greek theater, the actors, the Greek word for the actor was hypocrite or Hippocrates or whatever. And what it meant was somebody, and of course actors in Greek theater wore masks. So a hypocrite was somebody who wore a mask. And that I think is a helpful distinction to make because there are Christians who do promote one message but live according to a completely different standard knowingly that there are these two sides of their lives and that they are putting on a mask in public. And so in cases like the famous televangelist scandals or whatever, when it turns out that somebody has been preaching a certain message, especially if they've been trying to agitate for, legislating morality or whatever, and then it turns out that in their private life they've been going the exact opposite direction, I think that can justifiably be called hypocrisy. And I don't necessarily mind that being brought to light if it sort of, as you say, if it keeps us accountable. But the word hypocrite does get used really indiscriminately, and if anybody simply doesn't, if people come across a Christian and the Christian isn't a nice guy, what a hypocrite, He says he loves Jesus, but he's not a very loving person. That to me is a really loose use of the term, and I would rather avoid that kind of indiscriminate use of the word.
Right. That's Peter, thanks for that. Mike, Kevin, anything you'd want to add?
Well, I just want to throw something that the author says in the book. He says, frankly, if some non-Christians hold negative stereotypes about Christians, perhaps we should view it as their problem and not ours. He says, in my opinion, we Christians should worry much more about our views of others than their views of us. And so I think that's interesting. I agree that, the world should, we do claim a higher standard. We should be held accountable when we deviate from that standard. But recognizing nobody's perfect and nobody's claiming to be perfect. But at the same time, I think that a lot of Christians become confused, myself included, and we start to think that we're in the public relations business. And we're not in the public relations business, we're in the following Jesus business. And what that means is, if we've just followed Jesus, our public image will take care of itself. And that I think too often we get kind of just so focused on, oh no, people are saying bad things about us, how can we make people think better about us? I think we should just stop worrying about that and go, how can we just follow the two greatest commandments? If we do that, I think everything else sort of follows.
All right.
Just a sideways comment, I think, on the hypocrisy issue. I think we lull ourselves to sleep on it. I don't think anyone's going to doubt the issue of somebody preaches one thing and is living the double standard. But I think the hypocrisy issue is more around the whole issue of we say we love God and we love our neighbor. What does that mean? And probably most people, their neighbors have never been in their home. I think if we could change that a little bit, we could have a far greater impact. And people would start to come back to church. You start to connect with people, and you have a winsome personality. I think that's a big issue with hypocrisy. We just don't know how to, you know, walk across the room or reach our hand over the fence.
All right, so Mike's advocating hospitality. Art, you were nodding vigorously when Peter was talking. Anything you want to add before I move across the room?
No, my train of thought got interrupted by paying the bill here, so I'm...
Okay, it's important to pay your bills. Okay, thanks very much, Art. I'm going to move across the room to Connie, who's got some comments, thoughts, questions that she wants to direct to the panel. And then I'll be coming to Bruce right there, the reluctant engineer. Connie.
Thank you. I guess my response is, are we caught up in this... culture of celebrity and superficiality, and that as Christians we even kind of buy into this kind of thinking. I mean, is it naive and old-fashioned to suggest that Christians don't have a better response to this? And that when I think about why I want to be a believer, I think about my heroes, and I think about it was Christians that started churches. Yes, but they started hospitals. They started to improve health for people around the world. And I think we just get so caught up in the notion that somebody can say something negative. Christopher Hitchinson or Richard Dawkins, whatever his name is. And we just kind of react and we forget where we've come from. And the quiet heroes that are changing lives and their own around the world. And I just must share a personal experience. My daughter, who's a physician and a member of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative and travels all around the world working with people in disasters, said to me, you know, I was in Haiti a few months ago, and my daughter is not a Christian. She shared this. She said there was a group down there, and I was blown away. They're called Love a Child, and they're the people that are staying in Haiti and have been in Haiti before we ever got there. And boy, they do what they say they will do. What are we worried about? Why do we have to worry about all of this celebrity garbage? It just, yes, it's offensive, but boy, we got something so much bigger going on for us.
All right, thanks, Connie. So that's not really a question. Maybe it is. Why worry? Peter, you're waving your hand down.
I know I'm a hand waver today.
All right.
But before I respond to that, I just want to pick up on this whole bill paying thing. Speaking of Christian reputations, I've heard from many people who've worked in the service industries that Christians are renowned for being the worst tippers in the world. So if people in this room want to counteract that image, that'd be great, I'm sure. Anyway,
And you're buying dinner for the panel tonight, Peter, are you?
Well, I'm here at, you know, your invitation, so, but yeah, whatever. You know, I do try to make my own little difference that way. And I've heard that, of course, from Christians Christian friends of mine who've worked in the service industry as well. So it's a problem that everybody seems to perceive. But anyway, as far as Christians serving anybody or serving people, your comments remind me of Rodney Stark, who's one of the sociologists quoted in this book. He's written a book called The Rise of Christianity, and he devotes different chapters to looking at how the social factors that helped Christianity grow and spread in the Roman Empire. And one of the things he looks at is plagues. And the fact that diseases were very common in the ancient world, they didn't have the kind of medical treatment that we have today. And that in the ancient world, in pagan Rome, it was considered perfectly acceptable and rational for a doctor to skip out of town the moment a plague came, because that was how the doctor would survive. He would abandon, you know, the public and go off to his villa somewhere. Whereas the Christians, Christians themselves were the objects of all sorts of rumors. You know, the pagan Romans spread all sorts of nasty rumors about Christians because they were cannibals, because, you know, they ate the body and blood of Christ or whatever. Christians were supposedly incestuous because they referred to their wives as their sisters. You know, all these rumors people spread about the church when the church was initially a very, very small part of the population. But when a plague hit, the church, the Christians would stay in the city. They would not run for their lives and try to save themselves. They would stay in the city to tend to the people who couldn't leave, and they would look after people and take care of people, and this made a difference, and this was a major factor. And
that's been met with great enthusiasm.
I know.
Your apologetic is winning over the masses. Way to go, Peter.
Well, thank you. But I mean, you know, so this is an example of how Christians, it's not that there was a particular Christian apologist in the second or third century that blew away the arguments of the philosophers who hated Christianity. It's just that regular Christians on the ground were just, you know, loving people as Jesus told them to, sometimes at great personal cost, because you can't expose yourself to a plague, you know, without catching something. Somebody in your community is going to get hit by it. But just, you know, Christians doing loving things on the ground, does have an impact in the long term. So, yeah, I don't think we should get too caught up about the celebrities, as you call them. I mean, it's fun to get into those arguments with celebrities, but that's not where the real work is done.
All right. Mike, Kevin, ready for me to move on, or you got a pearl of wisdom that you want to wow us with? Okay.
I think ditto, agree. Let's move on.
Okay, let's move on indeed, and we'll move on to Bruce, who's at table 7 or table 15.
Thank you. Tolerance is a word that's used a lot today. The Ten Commandments would have not been considered tolerant. Christians have the good news, but realize the need for salvation is established when we realize our shortcomings, and the Ten Commandments establish the line in the sand. So how can we always be tolerant? We can always try to love or to show love, but I don't think we can always be tolerant.
Thanks, Bruce. So there we are, picking up maybe on the comment Mike Sherbino made about the great Canadian virtue of tolerance, and Bruce's is saying, hey, maybe Christ followers, to be faithful, have to be intolerant. Mike?
I think just a couple quick things. I think in the whole issue of tolerance, what we need to be is respectful. I think we have to really evaluate ourselves and say, am I racist? Am I prejudiced? And how does that come across? But I think it's also equally important to have an opinion and to be able to articulate it. And not to be ashamed of truth. But again, I would say this, that if we're going to win people, if we're going to make an influence, you can't have influence without impact. And it's very easy for us to sit back and throw words, but I'm all for saying, and in my own personal journey, is how do I personally impact the culture that's around me? Who do I hang out with? Who do I talk to? And I think at that point, then I'm in a place where I can share my convictions and my beliefs. Because down deep, my own conviction is that most people do have an opinion. But the herd mentality, which is very common in Canada, we're afraid to speak up. We don't want to offend anyone. Where I think speaking truth would help bring people into freedom. Just an opinion.
I'm never afraid to offend somebody, but I'm just kind of stuck here trying to figure out how the Ten Commandments are intolerant. I know they're definitely intolerant. Thou shalt have no gods before me. So intolerant to other gods.
They're absolutist, aren't they? I mean, they're not open to discussion. They're declarations. So maybe that's what makes them intolerant.
Well, I don't know. To me, I see them more as a guideline for how to have a civil society. You know, that in a sense, a way of preventing self-destruction, as opposed to something that really is a flagship for intolerance. I really failed to understand that.
Well, I'm thinking the firestorm around the Ten Commandments, which in my mind is a secondary issue, whether or not the Ten Commandments should be dotted around public lawns in the United States of America has been a firestorm. Behind it, though, is really a question about truth. Is there true truth, or should God's revelation be sidelined to the realm of private opinion or the religious country club? Maybe that's the collision.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Okay, Kevin stumped. That's pretty spectacular.
What you're just talking about is the discussion for an entirely different evening. What role does religion have in the public sphere? really. But I don't see that the Ten Commandments aren't really intolerant of other people's points of view. This is a sort of a mandate given to God, given by God to the Jews, basically saying, if you're going to follow me, these are the rules you have to follow. It's not so much saying that other points of view are not allowed for all time. Anyway, I just see them quite differently.
Okay, Peter's got something to say.
I just want to toss two really quick comments about tolerance in there. My favorite comment on tolerance comes from David Lamb, who was the lieutenant governor in BC some years ago. He said he didn't like the word tolerance because it sounded like somebody was, because he was Chinese Canadian. He wasn't white majority type of Canadian. He was a member of a visible minority. And he said he didn't like the word tolerance because it sounded like somebody was saying to him, "You stink, but I'll hold my nose." And so I've really been reluctant to use that word if I can avoid it at all. The other thing is that when people say that the Bible doesn't tell us to be tolerant, there is one very conspicuous use of the word, at least in some English translations, in Romans 2. We could have a whole evening just on that, but all I will say is that one of the, because since the gay debate has been raised tonight at some point, I will say that Romans 1 has one of the key passages in that debate. And I think it's very interesting that Romans 1 builds up to a certain crescendo that transitions immediately into Romans 2 and Paul telling people that if they condemn others outside the faith, they are, I forget the exact wording, but they are casting scorn on the riches of God's kindness, tolerance, and patience. And the word tolerance comes up in that context. And I won't even try to unpack that because there's too much to say, but I do think it's something worth looking into and worth checking out, is how Paul uses that concept there.
All right, well, there we go. More thoughts from Peter Chataway, who's never usually short of something to say. Thank you, Peter, Kevin, and Mike. What we like to do at the Kindlings is wrap up with a final thought, so you've got to condense your wisdom into a soundbite that will sizzle, so that when people leave our live event, they can savor your soundbite on the drive home, and as people listen to the podcast, they can treasure, no pressure, your pearl of wisdom. So, Kevin, on this whole issue of hypocrisy, Christianity, cultural perceptions, Bradley Wright's book, what would you like to leave us with as a parting thought?
Well, I would say two things. I have a friend who's a media consultant, and he wrote a book on basically 20 rules for how to deal with the media. And I think one of the only lessons I remember from it is frame or be framed. In other words, take control and frame the issue, or you're going to be framed by someone else, and probably not in a way that you're going to enjoy. So I think that's one way of dealing with a potential public image problem that Christians have, is to reframe the issue. I think too oftentimes we allow somebody to frame the issue for us, and then we start fighting what I would call a false dichotomy. Somebody just draws a line arbitrarily in the sand and says, you're on this side and you people are on this side, now duke it out. And we get stuck in these pointless battles that we never even created in the first place. But the second thing is, I would just want to return to what I said a bit earlier, is that I think that if you think Christians have a public image problem, maybe it's a time to prompt some self-reflection to say, how have I contributed to that problem? How have you contributed to that problem? But just to focus not so much on what do people think of me, but what does Jesus think of me? And how well am I doing at following the two greatest commandments? Because I just don't think it gets any more complicated than that.
Good words from Kevin. Thanks, Kevin. Dr. Mike.
I think on the issue of hypocrisy, let me just leave a thought. Maybe it'll percolate, grow somewhere. When the world couldn't care less, we have an opportunity to care more.
All right. Thanks, Mike. That? Follow that, Peter.
Five words or less.
Yeah. Five
worse.
Words or less.
That's
Greek,
worse than
Hebrew,
Twitter.
Or...
Primarily, I think I'd want to echo what Kevin said earlier tonight about not being, if I remember correctly, about not being too hung up on the public image and how we are perceived, but keeping our focus on following Christ and sort of letting everything else fall wherever it may. That would be my primary focus. Because Christians, in my experience, can be awfully self-conscious. And you know, I mean, I forgive me if there are any DC Talk fans in the room, but the album Jesus Freak, I never liked it because the title song is all about how, what will people say when they find out I'm a Jesus freak? And then there's another song on there, you know, what if I stumble? What if I fall? What if I make fools of us all? And I just didn't want to deal with all that focusing on ourselves baggage. I'd rather follow Christ.
All right. So there we are. Please express your appreciation to Mike Sherboneau, Peter Chataway, and Kevin Miller. And thanks for joining us at The Kindlings. Those of you here at the live event, podcast will be uploaded in the next day or two at thekindlings.ca. Follow us on Facebook, and we're going to activate the blog on the web. Feel free to fill in the info cards so that we can mail to you snail mail or email, and we can keep you posted on what's happening. Thanks so much for joining us at The Kindlings. Have a great night.